You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello, and welcome to another damn fine cup of culture. Joining me today are Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Julie.
And Sam. Good afternoon, Sam. Welcome.
Hey there, Julie.
And today we will be discussing the 1984 masterpiece, Amadeus. It's an older movie. There will obviously be spoilers as we'll be trying to unpack what this movie means, how good it is, what it's about, really. So if you haven't seen it, do yourself a favor, see it somewhere, find it somewhere, and come back to us some other time. All right, for starters, guys, when did you first watch Amadeus, and do you even remember?
100 years ago, it feels like, but at the moment, everything is 100 years ago, obviously. I actually watched this at the cinema when it came out in 1984, and I was 9 years old. I'm pretty sure, I mean, you know how it is with memories that long ago. I don't know what is made up, I don't know what is real, but I seem to remember that my dad, who is a musician who loves Mozart's music, took me and my sister to see it at the cinema. And perhaps differently from what you'd expect, even as a 9-year-old, I thought this was a fantastic film. I think I was a pretentious little so-and-so. I still agree with that pretentious little so-and-so, mind you.
You're so hard on yourself. All right, Sam, when did you pick it up? Because I think your first watch must be have been a little bit later.
I would think somewhere in the early 90s. My mother was a big Mozart fan, and there was classical music playing, especially Mozart music, like all the time in our house. And so I suspect the first time I saw it was with my parents when it came out on video, which could have been only in the early 90s, because before there was no video recorder in our house. But then I've seen it repeatedly since. I also don't remember when, but I do remember one particular screening with an orchestra a few years ago, and which made me reappreciate the film, and I was excited to see it again. And it was beautiful to see it with a live orchestra in Lucerne.
Wow.
It was good.
Oh, I'm jealous. I'm one of those people who don't remember. I saw it in cinema, I'm sure of that. It must have been one of those revival things where you go to a matinee where they rescreen an older film. They do that a lot. And it must have been around there that I saw it in the cinema. And I saw it in the cinema more than once. I remember that. Again, because they have different sort of theme matinee type things. And then, of course, I picked up the DVD and saw it again. I've also grown up with Mozart, like the two of you. We didn't have music in our house so much, but we went to shows a lot. And of course, Die Zauberflöte was one of my sort of... I was a very little girl when I first went to see that somewhere. I can tell you that. I mean, Mozart's music has been with me forever. So this film is a very great way to get reintroduced to some of his better known pieces. I used to play piano, so I was mostly familiar with sonatas and that sort of thing. And not so much with some of the pieces that we'll get into later in this podcast that are in this beautiful film. So we've rewatched it, and I think we can agree that it's still good, right?
Is there even a discussion about this?
But there was one point that Matt, you made that made me think of something. You said that even as a child, you really liked it. And I think that's what surprised me, that it's a movie that I think you like at all different ages, but possibly for different reasons. So I think it's kind of a movie for young and old, and both young and older audiences pick up on things that really work well in the film. So it was good, it has been good, and it is still very good in my mind.
I think it's good for kids, but with parental guidance, kids tend to like the farty joke thing. But yeah, I think even just for the music, I mean, oh my goodness.
I mean, I have to say, though, that, you know, regardless of little Matt liking it at the age of 9 and whatever that says about the film or about Matt, I think it is a film that most kids would, apart from the fart jokes, perhaps find boring, because in the end, it is about very heavy adult themes. It's about envy. It's about, you know, the creation of art and the kind of inspiration, but about the negative side of that, the dark side. I think it's a very intellectual piece, although it's not just intellectual. I think Miloš Forman made very earthy films, and this is definitely one of those earthy films. I'm kind of surprised. I mean, looking back, I don't know how much I project into 9-year-old me, because I think it's the kind of film that would go over most kids' head. I'm actually thinking that as a film, it perhaps goes over many people's head, because they look at, you know, they look at the poster, they look at the description, and they think it's one thing, a biopic, and that it isn't very much so, I would say.
No, you're giving me a very nice bridge, because let's go into the story a little bit. To state the blatantly obvious, this film is not in any way factual. It's a fable. I mean, one of my personal favorite facts about this film is that Mr. Salieri, who swears an oath of chastity in this picture, had 8 children and, according to legend, several mistresses. And all these other factual things, apart from all the fart jokes that Mozart really was very fond of, is all of it is fiction. I mean, we can just agree on that. It doesn't matter that it's fiction. And it goes into the subjectivity of the storyteller in this case, which is a not very well-known composer named Mr. Salieri. And from that framing, so his memories of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, we get into the actual meat of the story. And it's worth knowing that that was an actual play before it was a movie. The play is a little bit more stilted, less comedic, and less free-flowing in my head, at least, than the movie is. Maybe, Sam, you know a little bit more about the play, I think, than I do.
Well, we looked into it to put up a production of it, but it turned out that it was too difficult with those two very strong characters in the film, obviously, Salieri and Mozart. What they did add to the film version was a number of characters, most notably, if we talk of the subjectivity, this priest that Salieri tells his story to, and also a number of other side characters. It's just like broader in that sense. And also they added more scenes that actually Salieri could not have experienced himself. So the film expands on these scenes where Salieri was not present. But I think it still very well works with this frame that it put up at the very beginning. And you say, rightfully so, that it's clear from the start we're in this asylum. We have Salieri as a much older, aged and frustrated man who tries to kill himself, still haunted by the memory of thinking he has killed Mozart. And then he starts telling the story and we get those flashbacks. So that works really well in a filmic sense. So that's kind of something that they changed around. But also I think it should be clear for audiences that these are the memories of Salieri, how he remembers it, how he's guilt-ridden by thinking he has killed Mozart and by that jealousy that is so central to the film. That's what I can say from reading the play and seeing the movie now again.
Yeah, it's a very big theme, the way how can we cope with our own mediocrity in the face of genius? I think, Matt, you wrote down some thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the meat of the discussion will be about those themes. I would perhaps quickly want to come back to the whole thing about, you know, framing it as Salieri's memories. Of course, even those are fictionalized. I mean, as you said, basically both characters are fictions. It's a fable. In that respect, I'm pretty sure that, you know, to people who came at this from the angle of theater, they would never even ask the question of, is this a biopic? Is this factual or not? Because I think on the stage, we're much more used to things being explicitly fictional. I think, you know, if someone watches Richard III on stage, no one's going to say, is this a biopic or a biodrama? Is this what Richard III was really like? It's, I think, what you get at here to some extent is, I think, different traditions of viewing. And I think film is something that is more overtly realistic. That's the convention we have. It looks real. I mean, you also watch Mozart and Salieri in this film, and it all looks real. I know it's fictional, and still, when I think of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and of Salieri, I see Tom Hulce and I see F. Murray Abraham. I see those images. I think film just can be as fictional, and in this case is as fictional, but it has a certain power of capturing our imagination as this is what it looked like, this is what it was like. But in that respect, I do think the film is no different from something like Richard III. It very much reminded me of, have either of you seen Pablo Larraín's Spencer?
Yeah, I have.
Not yet.
I don't want to spoil anything, but I mean, this is also a film that takes Princess Diana in the mid-90s, but it starts by saying this is a fable from a true tragedy.
Exactly.
I think we have the same thing here. Or If you look at The Favourite, the film, when did it come out? A couple of years? The Lanthimos film?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Again, written by a playwright, or then you've got The Great, a series, Hulu series by the same playwright, Tony McNamara, which starts by saying, this is a mostly true story, which later on changes into, this is an almost entirely made-up story about Catherine the Great. You take certain types, you take certain patterns, you take certain cliches and images that people have in their heads, but you take those to tell a story. I mean, I don't think Amadeus is about Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. It's not about Salieri. As you said, it's about envy. It's about coming to grips or failing to come to grips with your own mediocrity in the face of genius.
Mm.
But still, you have to kind of take the fact that the effect of the film was still a huge revival of Mozart and his music, and even ironically of Salieri and his music.
Yes.
So what the film did was something that was almost the opposite of what the film says. It really made Salieri put him on the page and put him into people's minds. And so there is this odd mix, I think, of it being that great film about these themes and that jealousy at the center of it. But culturally, that's such an impact on the image of who Mozart was. Like you said, when we think of, especially if we should say Amadeus, you're always confronted with the image of Tom Hulce and the energy he portrays, this very American energy in the film. We can come back to that and to accents as well. And it's so such a 1980s sensibility as well, this kind of late punk kid who goes against all these stuffy musicians and stuffy government people, obviously. So it's that odd pastiche that has come out of this, a great film about other things, but then it had a huge impact on how we see Mozart, how many people without much knowledge on the real Mozart or the real Salieri see both of them up until today.
As to Mozart, the depiction of Mozart in the film, I almost understand Ebert's comment in his review that he wrote about the film is that it's disturbingly true in a metaphorical sense, because Mozart was fond of fart jokes. Mozart was somebody who liked to spend money on parties. It's not this suffering genius, you know, who is stuck in his own angsty, crushed by his genius. He's having fun. And I think in a way that gives the concept or the idea of the historical Mozart rather a nice twist. I think it's plausible that partly or in a way, he was this fun-loving guy. He was quite young, enormously successful, traveling around the world, having parties, stuffing his face. I mean, why not? You know, so in that sense, it's as you rightly point out, Matt, it's a fable about a real life. And there's something real, I think, in that. More so, I think, than with Salieri, who I don't really get a sort of feel for at all as a historical personality.
Can I perhaps just ask the two of you something? I mean, the film is called Amadeus, but who would you say is the main character? If you have to decide on one character, who is the main character of Amadeus?
Salieri, to me.
Yeah.
I remembered him much more, and I remembered his F. Murray Abraham performance together with his performance in The Name of the Rose. Those were two of the most impressive performances in my early teenage. I was such a fan of his just because of these two movies. And he's clearly for me the main character. And I think he has also way more screen presence. I didn't like calculate it all together. I think he's in the movie in most of the scenes.
Yeah, and it's all his viewpoint. The entire film is his viewpoint and his memories. So rightly, he's the somewhat unreliable narrator of this story. That makes him a main.
I'm not sure I would fully agree with that. I agree that he comments on everything, but I don't think that the film as such presents it as being focalized through him, because we do have scenes that Salieri isn't present for. And I think in that respect, it is like the stage thing. We see these people from an outsider's perspective, but it's always commented on by Salieri. We always have his, you know, what he thinks about them, which obviously filters it to some extent. But I don't think this is a film that, in what we see, is highly subjective.
Well, it's his voiceover, let's say.
That I would agree with, yes.
Because he tells us how to interpret what we've just seen, right? With a starting scene, very famous starting scene, where he follows through all these whole beautiful hallways, beautiful Baroque hallways, and he comes upon this giggling sophomoric kid fondling his girlfriend under a table, and he says in this beautiful voice of his, he says, "That was Mozart.
That creature, yes, I love that.
That creature. And this is he's explaining to us what to feel about this, except sort of befuddlement. He is the one who gives weight to this entire scene. In that sense, it's through him that we view
but,
the action.
Would we agree with him to that extent? Because I think from the beginning, he's introduced as a very specific character and also not a necessarily very likable character. I mean, you mentioned the thing about the vow of chastity, and I think that is perhaps given a bit more weight in the director's cut. That was not cut by the director, ironically.
Yeah.
But I think, especially in the theatrical version, if I remember it correctly, he does come across as someone who's got an eye for the ladies, and he overcompensates by basically transposing his lust into gluttony.
Yeah.
But he is a hypocrite. I mean, from the beginning, Salieri is, he is a hypocrite. He is arrogant. He is someone who wants to be way more important than is warranted. And I think while I agree with some of his take on Mozart, I mean, he is a horrible teenage git. I don't think I, as a viewer, feel I have to take over Salieri's point of view 100%.
This is so interesting. This makes me a bad person. I don't agree with Salieri's take on Mozart. I don't, because he's just a kid. What do you want? On the other hand, I liked him as an old guy. When he starts talking to his confessor, to his father confessor, who incidentally is about half his age, which is ridiculous, I liked him immediately. He has an impishness that just drew me in terms of, not that he's likable or particularly, I don't know, he's a bit louche, but I was totally like, I want to know what this guy has to say. This is so interesting. So I was very much drawn to his character.
Same for me, Julie. Same for me. I also thought that the beginning was spot on. I was immediately with that Salieri, also with that vicious energy he had, testing the priest, you know, if it's that the music of Salieri or if it's the music of Mozart. And then, of course, the priest falling for it and falling into that pit of jealousy that Salieri tried to lure him into. I don't quite agree, I think, with you, Matt, that I couldn't connect with Salieri as a... Like, I got his perspective, especially because once he sees Mozart as this foolish kid, we immediately change then to him appreciating the music that he hears. And I think that's one of my favorite parts of the movie, the way he dissects and analyzes Mozart's music and how we, through Salieri, get to appreciate the different layers of Mozart's music. And that's so beautifully done, this contrast between... There was this kid, but then, as he says, the voice of God was speaking through him. I understood that God was punishing me through this vessel of this child. And I think that's where I'm really drawn into the movie, where I get the emotion and the humanity of that character in that really well portrayed jealousy. It's really a great movie about envying someone and feeling like someone left you on your own wits. And here, in that sense, God kind of abandoned Salieri. And that's so powerful. And that's why I root so much for this character, even though he's unlikable as well.
It's so very relatable, because what I remember of the play, and I am sorry if I get this wrong, but it tended to be bogged down with these huge themes. Because the film is a little bit more comic and a little bit livelier to my sensibilities, I sort of relate to the fact that you know that you're not as good as you maybe could be, or not... that could be, you're successful in your own way, and you sort of muddle through. And here comes someone, you're confronted with someone who does this without half a thought, without even blinking, with hardly a breath, just spews out the music of the spheres, apropos of nothing. And he is not particularly virtuous, not particularly clever, and he's not particularly intellectual. And he's none of these things. And he's just imbued with this gift that's, for some reason, you can never reach, and you know you can never reach. I find that a very human, not thematic in the abstract sense per se, but a very human thing, is that you second guess everything that you've accomplished. I can get that somehow.
Oh, totally. I mean, I'm definitely not saying I don't relate to him. I just think that he is doing too much of a job as a manipulator for us not to at least get that he is manipulating us. And he's fun as a manipulator. I mean, he's almost a, you know, satanic figure in the sense of, you know, John Milton. You want to listen to this guy because he's snarky, he's clever, he's intelligent. He plays that priest like a fiddle, and he destroys him in the process. He destroys the priest's idea of what God is and what justice is. And it's fun. You want to watch it. I mean, that's the thing. In a way, Salieri, as presented in Amadeus, he's a genius of a very different kind. He's a genius in his spiteful, manipulative, ego-driven crusade against Mozart. I do think...
Are you saying he's a politician?
Yes, but I mean, that's the thing. The film, I think it's, apart from anything else, it's also satire about politics, and you've got the whole court, and you've got the different types there. You know, the emperor who's... I love that performance. I mean, Geoffrey Jones is fantastic in it.
He is.
The emperor who... It's he tries to be intellectual, he tries to be a patron of the arts, but he's just tone deaf and stupid, and you know, it's a wonderful performance. I think there's a lot of satire there of politics. Salieri is kind of in between. Yes, he is also off that political sphere, but I think that's where one of the interesting elements comes in. It's not just that he sees genius and can't be, you know, a genius himself. It's also that he is the only one who truly, you know, realizes what Mozart is. Everyone around him is blind to some extent. They think, yeah, that kid, he's probably good. He will go places if he learns how to shut up and, you know, do what he's told. But Salieri is the only one who gets that. Again, we're talking about, you know, the themes of the film, that in a way, divine inspiration speaks through this kid. And Julia said before that, you know, it does so effortlessly. I don't think that is quite entirely true, because it very soon starts to also burn up Mozart. I mean, Mozart is a double victim, I think, in this film. He's a victim in that he's being burnt up by the genius that flows through him, and then he's also being destroyed by the man who envies him for it. And that I find very poignant.
Yeah, in the sense that to Salieri... He has a quote in the film that he says something like, this music just comes out of him fully formed. He just writes down what is already in his head. Stanzi has another quote of a similar vein where she says, write it down, Wolfie, it's no use to anybody in your head. That is the sort of thing that I'm alluding to, is that he has to still work very hard, but to the outside world, it's almost as if he just has this music fully formed. All he has to do is write it down. It's just given to him from above. And I think that's the outside world's take. So Stanzi's take, Salieri's take on Mozart. What actually Mozart feels about it does not become entirely clear to me, apart from, of course, the daddy issues.
I was going to bring up the conflict with his father. I think the film also really worked well for me, because all these three, I would call them three main characters, Stanzi, Amadeus, and Salieri, they both are very understandable in their conflicts that they're in. And they're all, of course, related to each other somehow. Stanzi trying to make her husband write down the music more and make it more profitable, and going for the profitable assignment versus the one that's just like fun and creative when he writes the magic flute versus the Requiem at the end. And then the two main characters, of course, and their relationship with each other, but then also the conflict that Mozart has with the expectations of his dad, not really living up to the standard of the court, always being oppressed by the Italians, who tell him that he's, you know, his music is not as good as Italian and should also be in Italian, of course. And he pokes jokes at them, but he's also suffering. And then, of course, the suffering that we've already mentioned. So I think this triangle worked really well for me. Also, the way Salieri tries to abuse Stanzi, but then somehow decides otherwise, still humiliates her. I had the feeling this was a movie about humiliation. And there were so many scenes where a character is being humiliated, and Salieri makes it maybe the most obvious, and he also speaks of these moments of humiliation over and over again. But I also felt that the same was true for Mozart. He never quite reached the position he felt he deserved. And also for Constanze, trying to do good for her husband, make his career take off and make a life for the family, that also she also felt humiliated in a way throughout the film. So that felt very strong, this sense of humiliation.
I want to just briefly interject to go to a tiny, tiny tangent, because if we talk about Constanze's humiliation, it's worth saying that the scene in which she is literally on screen humiliated by Salieri, where she is made to undress and then he calls in the servant, that was not, in my memory, in the original theatrical cut. That is a scene that was only there in the DVD cut. Refused to call it a director's cut, because it's not. So that was not there. And it's interesting because you do need that scene, as Sam, you rightly said, because in a sense it is about, not about humiliation as an act or as a verb, but being humiliated just because of the position you find yourself in, like being stripped of your dignity by fate, almost. So we do need that scene. I prefer the theatrical cut, but I thought I would just interject that that scene is only there in sort of the DVD, the longer cut of the film.
I was surprised to see some of the scenes that I'd never seen before. I felt also the one with the dogs and Kenneth MacMillan, this character who actually did not appear in other scenes. So he was a completely new character to me. I just seen him in June in the old version. I was like, that's the Baron. That's the Baron. And there's lots of famous faces. Geoffrey Jones, Matt, I have to agree. I checked that he was the principal in Ferris Bueller's Day Off 2 years after this. But I felt it was kind of the same comedic energy. And I think the film works so well because there's so many comedic moments as well. Maybe going back to what you said at the beginning, Matt, about the child accessing that film. I think it works so well because I think a younger audience would maybe pick up more on the comedy, on these funny caricatures of the emperor and the musicians around him and the staff around him kind of trying to please him. And then him being also humiliated sometimes by, you know, his lack of knowledge and just by his plain stupidity.
His incompetence.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you could go so far as just to call it a comedy or a dramedy. I mean, the comedy is like, in moments, it's really broad as well. I think people tend to forget, they think of it as this drama with comedic elements and costumes, but it's, I think you could go as far as to call it a comedy. I mean, the wigs, the giggle, again, the fart jokes ever present. Emperor Joseph, I think it's the second Joseph, who has just no idea what he's doing.
But I remember laughing a lot, you know, as a teenager about this film with my friends. There would be lots of things that we'd be laughing at in that movie. It was fun. It's highly entertaining. But there is that twist towards the Requiem, which I think then makes the film not only great comedy to a certain extent, but it really also makes it then dark, the whole father-son conflict and turning into that musical assignment. And then the film really goes into a very different direction and harks back to the beginning very differently from what we maybe expected. So I do like that final act, that final third a lot, because it makes it so much like deeper and more humanly relatable.
Yeah, the Requiem, I think it's interesting. If you look up our listeners, look up the Requiem, Moses Requiem, what they use is a specific movement where I think it's where the souls are called to God. They use a very specific piece of that Requiem. If you start with the first movement, you probably won't recognize it from the film. It's a very interesting choice that they make there. And I can guess at the reasons why they take this movement, this bit, the Confutatus Maledictus. But I think it's that you're always torn between heaven and hell and the divine and the polluted and something like that. If I want to try and be half intellectual here. But it's also an interesting scene because the Requiem was commissioned by a secret commissioner who was not Salieri, by the way, in real life. And Mozart was at that time very much under pressure and suffering from health issues. So there again, it's a fable. It's all fake, but there's a line towards something that you can almost feel is there's a truth at the core of it somewhere in there.
Yeah, when I was a kid, probably around the same age as when I, you know, first watched Amadeus, I remember at the library there was this book. It was basically a history of music in comics. And I still remember what it did there. Basically, it told also on some pages the story of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart and basically how, you know, he was so amazingly inspired and creative, but he was also, he suffered from health problems, probably addiction problems, alcoholism, quite possibly, and that he then died. What was he, in his early 30s? Very, very young when he died, and he was basically buried in a pauper's grave. I mean, basically, that's what the film does. Later in the comic, what it does, it then tells the story of some rock star, I don't know, some of the Janis Joplin or whatever. And it basically told that story. And then it ended with exactly that, you know, and at the age of so-and-so, Mozart died broke and was buried in a pauper's grave. So it also did this thing of kind of turning the story into a fable. And I think that's the thing that we have here. It's like, he's not a tortured character. He's a fun-loving character, but he is tortured by his art and that it is burning him up. I mean, he does seem to be suffering from addiction problems. He's a boozer. I mean, there's empty wine bottles in his flat. You almost can't walk through the flat without falling over them. But you get the impression he's almost doing this to numb the inspiration that is burning him up. And that I've always found that very impressive and scary in the film.
I like the rock star parallel because it's very apparent that this is what the filmmakers are after. Mm-hmm. They want this rock star type character transported into Mozart's time with all the politics and the backstabbing and see what happens. And it works remarkably, remarkably well to have a look at, let's say, Mozart the rebel without a cause.
Yes. And that brings me back to that 1980s sensibility I mentioned a while ago. Also, you know, the choice of wigs, the wigs he's wearing, I'm not sure if they're like yes. historically accurate, but I also read up on a couple of people that wanted to play the character. They had Mick Jagger in mind. There were David Bowie. They even thought of Andrew Lloyd Webber at one point, Mark Hamill, Tim Curry, Kenneth Branagh.
Bowie.
They had lots of people. Yeah, they had.
Wow.
So you see, they were definitely trying to go for this 1980s rock star or 70s rock star, probably more likely. And earlier on for this character, there was a sense to also cast someone to represent that, a movie that's set in the 18th century, but then has complete 1980s sensibilities to it. Matt, there was something in the preparation of the podcast that I wanted to come back to, talking of the 1970s. At one point, I think it was you saying that the film was more, had the style or the sense of more like a 1970s cinema. And I was wondering if you could say to what extent you felt that.
Mm-hmm. I think some of it you've already kind of alluded to. I do think that this comes very much out of the rock stars of the 60s and 70s on the one hand, but I think it also very much comes out of Miloš Forman being from Czechoslovakia, having been one of the leading figures in the Czechoslovak New Wave. And those films, I mean, if you watch them, I haven't seen too many of them. I've sadly not seen any of Forman's films from that time, but so many of the Czechoslovak films of that time are amazingly subversive. But they're always subversive in a way that on the surface, in a very overt way, you have complete deniability. You know, this is not a film making fun of the communist leadership. This is a film making fun of, I don't know, small-time officials. This is a film making fun of the fireman's brigade. Or this is a film making fun of late 18th century or mid 18th century Viennese courts. So I think you have this kind of sensibility. It's also more political sensibility that you have in the 60s, 70s films, this anti-authoritarian thing that Miloš Forman definitely also had in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Hair. And I think that is something that is almost entirely gone in much of 80s cinema. When I think of classic 80s movies, it is very much Reaganite time. It's a very individualistic time. I think also action films and all of that, you tend to lose the kind of political subtext, and it's almost stripped of political things. I mean, if I think of 80s films, obviously you can't reduce it all to Rocky IV, but in a way you have much more this rah-rah America. And I think what you have here is really much more this anti-authoritarian, anti-establishment, punky vibe. But punk then being destroyed by the old jealous men who feel these kids are too much for us. We can't be them, but we can destroy them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, because I was reminded as well, obviously, of another, or maybe the other really famous Forman film, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, especially with that beginning at the asylum. Obviously, there's also some visual parallels, but also just the basic setup of someone coming into a world not really fitting in and then putting this world upside down. Authorities trying to rein him in, and in the end, the authorities winning over him and destroying him in the process. So I thought that the basic feel of that, the basic message, and also the emotional journey I was making was quite similar to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, even though the story is very, very different, obviously. But Forman seems definitely to be like pulled to those types of stories.
Yeah, and it's just such a lovely factoid. I think you both mentioned A, the wigs, and B, the movie version of Hair. And I cannot help seeing the parallels there with, you know, he must have had such fun with those pink, baby blue, punk rock, baroque wig type things. I just think it's something that I think he just relates to outsiders in a way. People just who are anti-establishment in their own way. And I think Mozart in a sense was, at least in part, certainly that. It's not a political film, I don't think, in that sense. He's not a political figure. But he's certainly portrayed as this sort of the Janis Joplin of the Baroque age.
You don't think that the court, its depiction is political?
Well, not in the sense that it is a message. It's not telling the audience, you know, the point of this movie is that politicians are so bloody stupid that they have to crush genius wherever they find it. I don't think that's the message I take away from it. Of course, they're all stupid or maybe intelligent, but just don't care about genius or just so self-involved. But that's comedy. Very classical sort of Fawlty Towers type comedy that I don't see as a message in the sense that a political satire would be.
I think to me it's also that court very much, the way they're depicted, the way they're acted, reminds me totally of, you know, the kind of caricatures that you get in the 18th century, the Rake Progress, that kind of thing. I think it is that kind of satire, and I think political satire very often is very close to bawdy comedy because it is subversive, because it is, you know, it pulls down stuff that presents itself as lofty and makes it earthy.
I look at it this way. What did they actually change from reality in this film, from what we know about history? Is that one of the significant things that they change is that they show Mozart directing his operas to empty houses. And the operas that they pick for this are Don Giovanni and the Magic Flute, I think it's in English. These were always played to packed houses, right? In fact, they were wildly successful. Everybody went to see them. They were not suppressed. Nobody was trying to not get any tickets sold for that. They changed that to show politics trying to stay in control. Jealous old guys trying to suppress the new, trying to suppress the revolutionaries, trying to suppress the new ideas. That is, I think that's a truth, and I think that's worth satirizing, but that doesn't make it a specific political satire. That just makes it a movie that looks at politics and people in power and goes like, I mean, you've been asses since the 14th century. Look at you, and you're still asses now. So I see that satire and I see the link towards, you know, Rake's Progress type cartoons. But that does, to me, that doesn't make it a particularly political movie in the sense that Cuckoo's Nest is a political movie.
I agree. We don't have any connection that we make to, for instance, the age of Reagan at the time. It wasn't a comment on anything particular going on at the time. But you're right, Matt. It actually did the actors that they chose for these roles, they do look almost exactly taken out of these 18th century cartoons. Yeah. I mean, it's striking. Even Geoffrey Jones, who I got to know in other roles much later, he was always the emperor for me. Even in later films when I saw him, I thought, oh, he's the emperor from Amadeus because he looks so archetypical, like this type of emperor of that time. But I do agree, I didn't get, even this time, I didn't get any sense that this was talking about something present day at the time.
By the way, talk about comedy. I mean, F. Murray Abraham, and I keep getting reminded of this, when he finished The Name of the Rose, he wanted to go back to comedy because he played a lot of comedy. This man played a lot of Shakespeare comedy and that sort of thing. So even he, so the most, I'm almost tempted to say the most charismatic character in here, has a history of comedy.
Mm-hmm. And did go back to comedy later on with Wes Anderson. And I was thinking, if you look at the cast also, this Vincent Schiavelli coming up in a very small role at the beginning. I know him from comedies, among other things. There's Cynthia Nixon, you know, of later Sex and the City fame in her first role at 19. So there's like comedy people, I think, all over the film.
So, I mean, Cynthia Nixon is heartbreaking in this, in a relatively small part. I mean, there's nothing comedic about her part at all. Because, I mean, she also comes in very much during the last third. And I think that's also, I mean, you both talked about this, the way the film shifts from more comedic, more satirical to tragedy. And I think that's why it's very interesting to also see how Salieri changes, because at the beginning, he's fun, he's snarky, he's manipulative, he's devilish, and all of that is great. But the thing is, I mean, again, we talked about Mozart being destroyed by the powers that be, but the thing is, Salieri himself is not so much the powers that be, he's also a bit of an outsider. he is the one who gets what Mozart is, where everyone else does not. If he just left everyone else doing what they do, the story might have turned out very differently. But it's the one who understands this genius and who also cherishes that genius, who then destroys that genius. And in destroying it, realizes what he's doing and what he's done. I mean, that last scene between Amadeus and Salieri is just such a masterclass of turning Salieri from one kind of character into a different one. He does not cherish destroying Amadeus in the end because he realizes what he's doing. And that I find amazingly well done.
This is something I wrote down on my cuneiform notepad. I said, with the underlines in the Victorian vein, this is why jealousy is such a disease. It sickens him from the very first moment that he's starting to sicken right at the very beginning. Just the envy is just eating him up like a cancer. It's an incredible performance, really incredible.
And it's a riveting scene. They're both playing off each other so well in that. And also the use of music again in that one, how they put together the Requiem and how Salieri for a while, he's just like overchallenged. He can't follow Mozart for a while. And there's this dynamic that just like heightens and heightens until, of course, Mozart is completely exhausted and then soon after dies. Magnificent scene then.
Which gives me a lovely bridge because I do want to talk to the music and go into the way that the music, the actual Mozart music is used in this film a little bit more because we haven't quite gotten around to that apart from the Miraculous Requiem, which is an incredible piece of composition even now. And everybody wants it at their funeral, I think. I think I have some notes here about the timing. Take it from the top of the film, the way the music is introduced and the timing. I think, Sam, you had some thoughts on that.
I was planning to talk about that before I saw the movie again. And then after seeing it, I was surprised by two things. In a way, the movie does not use so much music of Mozart. Like the range of works that it's from is not so big. There's about three operas. There's that Serenade, number 10 in B-flat, that plays several times and that Salieri admires so much at the begining. Then, of course, the Requiem is very, very large at the end and at the very beginning. And there's one symphony. The range is not as big, but it's really well and put into much detail for the audience to really appreciate the music. And then, of course, there's Salieri's music. But I was also struck by is just the musical spotting, where the music is, where it begins, where it ends. Obviously, it's a very conscious decision because it's meant to be there. It's not something that the characters or Salieri does not want us to hear or is not aware of. But we as the audience enter Mozart's music through Salieri's appreciation of it. And I was reminded during that concert in Luzern how good also the quality of those recordings is. One of my friends just commented on the fact that these performances by the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields and Sir Neville Mariner conducting is so good, is so strong, that any orchestra imitating that would somehow not bring the precision and the clarity of music to the film. And that was obvious. It was interesting to see where the orchestra would play, because in a film music concert, you actually do see that live, where exactly they begin and they end. But it's also stunning the quality of music and recordings they put in there and where in the films.
Yeah, because I had a question for you. I'm always interested. I'm approaching this very much as a movie, not as a score. I'm always interested in how a film uses source music and scores as in an underscoring of the film and how this film plays with this. And I'm reminded of the scene very much in the beginning where Mozart is still having his groping session and the music starts and he holds out his hand and says, "They've started without me." And he runs through this hallway, through this serene clarinet sound, runs and runs and runs to go and conduct his piece of music. And that the timing of this is just, it's incredible because it brings it from what you think is maybe a score underneath or an atmospheric bit into actual source music that he's then actually conducting in scene. And they do this a couple of times with a nice little, is it a harpsichord or a virginal? I never know. Instrument where he improvises on Salieri's composition, where it's source music and it plays, the Requiem is being composed in scene, whereas it's used as a score underneath the scene in which it is being composed. That sort of stuff just fascinates me, how they use that. It's incredible.
It's magnificently done. And it ties in very well also with that seamless transition between flashback and going back to Salieri, sometimes just for a sentence, and then going back into the scene. I think the editing and the musical editing and the way it's put together is just astounding from beginning to end.
Yeah, totally.
Because sometimes it's just an actor on a stage actually singing the actual opera on an actual stage, which is in a scene, which is then in the cinema, right? It's a very cute little affectation, I think.
And then you've also got the absence of music that I think is used well. I mean, you remember the scene where basically there's a little dance in one of the operas. I think it's what is it called in English? The abduction from the Serai?
Isn't it the Nozze di Figaro at this point?
That's the one where basically they say, you know, oh, you can't have ballet in opera. It's been, you know, it's been prohibited. The emperor himself had a decree against it. So you have them doing the dance without music, and you just hear the silly, silly sound of their, you know, padded feet kind of going padum, padum, padum. And it is utterly ludicrous because of the absence of music. And the emperor himself comes in and says, what is this? Is this modern? Which is one of the fantastic lines in this film. Is this avant-garde? And he says, this is silly. Bring back the music. You know, screw my decree. This has to be done with music. And you've got the music and you've got the dance. And it works. It falls into place. What was ludicrous is sublime. I mean, in a way, I think it's almost a crime that the film was nominated amongst many, many other things for editing and for best sound. It got the one for sound, but not for editing. But in this film, more than almost in any other I can remember, the two go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. You can't separate the musical, the kind of sound editing, from the editing as a whole. And as you said, I think it's perfect. I think it's one of those films that I've never seen the stage version, but I'm not sure I want to, because the film is such a fantastic adaptation of the material that I can almost not imagine watching the stage version and not being utterly disappointed, because there's so much that the film does that is utterly cinematic, that just works, that brings this material to life.
It's worth reiterating that the selection that they use of Mozart's works is so sparse. There are really just a few pieces, I think, to bring out the full potential of, as you say rightly, Sam, the recording, the way that it's conducted and on the score, and to just really point out these few pieces that are special, because Mozart was very prolific. I mean, there are stacks and stacks. I can't even imagine having to choose one. If somebody called me up tomorrow and said, Jules, can you pick out a piano sonata for... I would go like, dude, do you know how many of those there are? Are you insane? It's a very, very beautiful way of putting his music on screen that doesn't feel overstuffed, I think. Mm-hmm.
And I think it goes back to something we said at the very beginning, that this is such a good film about Mozart by just taking bits and pieces. Maybe that goes together with what was said about the facts and the fiction. In a way, the movie also makes a very narrow selection of the music, really uses it well, arranges it well, interweaves it well to this whole that we perceive as something that is truly about Mozart. And we don't even fact check. Like I said at the beginning, I did never fact check because it was such a good film about Mozart to me.
But it also, I think it emphasizes the fable bit, because I mean, if you had more Mozart music, you might also get to the point where you realize this one is nice, but it's not as nice as the others. I mean, in some ways it is some of the greatest hits, but not used to be greatest hits. They're used thematically. I mean, Don Giovanni is in there because of the daddy issues.
The Königin der Nacht.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. The mother-in-law.
Which is hilarious.
Fantastic.
With the mother-in-law. It's absolutely gorgeous. I never laughed so loud.
Totally. The music all has a thematic point to make. And perhaps because of that, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if much of the selection was already in the original play, exactly because of that. But of course, it's not just that, it's also incidental bits. And I think it's supplemented perfectly by the selection that they've made. And I agree, that can't have been easy.
Of course, you have to have Papageno. And of course, I mean, some of them are just chew-ins, are obvious. Of course, you have to have Don Giovanni. And it's a way of approaching Don Giovanni as well, which is a very classical sort of almost old-fashioned take on it, which I kind of enjoyed. Because I don't think the modern versions that I saw are much, much lighter footed. But they have clearly have a vision where they're going, what type of interpretation they're going to put on these operas, or these tiny little snippets of opera that they're going to use. And they love their arpeggios, these endless, endless scales, which I've always hated so much in my piano lessons because I had to do them over and over and over again. And I once said about this movie to one of my coaches, one of my piano coaches, is that since I've seen this movie a couple of times, sometimes I got to a very difficult bit in some sort of piano sonata somewhere, and I could just imagine that manic giggle in the back of my head while trying to practice these arpeggios and getting them perfect, you know.
There's one fun fact that I would like to mention. Do you know what the name of the musical supervisor was on this film? Johann Strauss.
Oh, no.
John Strauss. I had to laugh out so loud in the credits at the beginning. I was like, okay, Johann Strauss did this movie on Mozart. Okay.
It's fake. Let's go into, just segue a little bit into the awards thing, because Matt, I think you mentioned like this entire slew of Oscars that they picked up, and they were I think Oscars are always a little bit torch, but this was a package of the most illogical Oscar ever awarded to the right film. It just did not make a lot of sense to me the way that this, I think that they just, the Academy didn't know what to do with it. What do you think?
I mean, I've said that I think that the film editing, it should have gotten an Oscar for editing. I would have to look up what else got the Oscar at the time. And I mean, if it was some Scorsese film, a Schoonmaker film, I don't want to get into a fight about that one. I do think that most of the Oscars that it did win were spot on, but Best Cinematography it didn't get. It was just nominated. That obviously is wrong, wrong, wrong. I think the thing that's totally ironic is that both of the leads, if you want to put it like that, so both Tom Hulce as Mozart and F. Murray Abraham were nominated as Best Actor. Fair enough. I think they are both leads, even if I would say that F. Murray Abraham is more of a lead. So you had the rivalry depicted in the awards.
Weird.
But in this case, it was Salieri that won. It was F. Murray Abraham that won. So I think those do make sense. Also, things like Best Adapted Screenplay, I do think it is one of the best adapted plays into cinema.
Well, I mean, it was already a play. They spruced it up. They worked very closely with the playwright. Is it an adaptation?
It is, because it's a different medium. I mean, if you look at other things, like, for instance, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, a film that I love.
Me too.
But it's a film that clearly shows that they didn't quite know how best to handle the transition. And when they most tried to transition, they actually failed most, because it feels so kind of, it sticks out like a sore thumb.
Hmm.
In this one, I think there's, it is obviously, you know, written by someone who knows language inside and out. In that respect, it shows that it comes from the stage, but it never feels stagey. It feels totally like a creature of the cinema to me.
That's a fair
point. So I would say that, you know, in subtle ways and in obvious ways, it is, for me, possibly the best adaptation of a play that I've ever seen on film.
It's a great adaptation. And going back to the play that I've recently, or more recently read, it works really well as a play on paper. And it never feels like a play watching the movie to me as well. It's very, very strong. I would agree with Matt. One point that I did research on was like how many movies were nominated that way, that like two main actors were nominated and then only one of them won. And there are a number of them, a number of great ones like Beauty and the Bounty, Judgment at Nuremberg, Network, Beckett. So that happened before, but I think in this one it had extra weight, especially with the competition depicted in the movie, and then Salieri, to everyone's enjoyment, winning. But of course, a bit sad for Tom Hulce. And I wanted to bring up this issue that was often discussed in connection with Amadeus, and I think Matt, you mentioned as well, the Oscar curse, that both of them became really famous through this film, but one won the Oscar, but both of them kind of disappeared. And there was this thing that there was a curse of the Oscar also for Louis Fletcher in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, famously in a Milos Forman film, but also quite a few others. To what extent is that true? I think there was some disagreement that we had on that. Like, did it kill their careers or didn't?
Yeah, it's so interesting, because part of it is it comes from an interview, and I've had a hard time finding primary sources here. But apparently it's a thing. And Dreyfus apparently had an Oscar jinx and other people. And the explanation has usually been very generally is if you're very young and you win an Oscar, there's a lot of pressure. And that pressure can lead to stress, that it can lead to anxiety issues, addiction. It can lead to substance abuse issues, which just do happen a lot, because they happen to a lot of people, and also in Hollywood. the Abrams thing is that he kind of had a hiatus of about 10 years in his career where it really slowed down. But then in retrospect, and this, I know this is 2020 hindsight, and I'm so sorry, but in retrospect, I mean, he worked with the Coen brothers. He worked with Wes Anderson. He played Shakespeare. He did Waiting for Godot. And there's a tendency to think that just because somebody goes back to the stage, that they are no longer in the picture, so to speak. And you see a lot of actors that I'm like, who is this great actor in so-and-so TV show, whom I've never seen and is so great? It invariably turns out that they were like off-Broadway endlessly for eons and eons and won a ton of prizes. And I'd never heard of them because I was never on or off-Broadway to see their shows. And I think we have to, I mean, in the case of Abram, it's partly true because he was out of the picture for a while and then he picked it back up. But Hulst, for instance, actually actively quit acting. He said so. He said, I quit. And this is why we've never seen him again. Well, that makes sense. If you quit acting, he went on to be a producer. So there is a myth-making in the film. There's a myth-making of Salieri, of most of their rivalry that plays out in the real world, in the Oscars. And then there's a myth-making around the Oscars with Oscar jinxes and things, which to my mind is seldom a thing, except when it intersects with actual mental health issues, as I earlier put, because those exist, obviously, and people can succumb to pressure. That's fair enough. But when I look at a career like Abrams, I cannot, in good faith, call that jinxed in any way, shape, or form. I mean, if you get to work with Coen Brothers, if you get to work with Wes Anderson, I think you're blessed. I really do. And he himself has said, and again, I can't find the primary source for this, but he apparently himself has said that he was in the rather unique position that he's won an Oscar and dined with royalty, but can also go on a subway and nobody will know who the heck he is. And that is quite a luxury position to be in. So I don't think he himself suffers a lot from having his Oscar.
Rather a blessing than a curse. And it seems to be also very short-sighted if you just see that they don't make any great films in maybe, like you said, within the next few years, and then they're somehow jinxed and cursed and they're out of the picture. I think that's just a lot of actors and actresses who have longevity and who are able to kind of come back in a different way or go back to the theater and just have as marvelous a career, maybe an easier career than a big movie star.
Or TV. I mean, Abraham was in Homeland and I think he won an Emmy. I think he won two. So he was on television. I mean, I think that's a spectacular career, especially nowadays. So I know that Hollywood loves to tell stories about itself, and I love telling stories about Hollywood telling stories about itself, so I'm equally guilty. But I think such a large part of it is mythologizing.
I do think there's another aspect, though. I mean, the Oscar curse, yes or no, I think that's, yeah, a bit of, you know, kind of silly fun mythology. But I do think that these are amazing parts that they had. And I think what in some ways for me as an audience member was a bit disappointing was that once you see an actor do such an amazing job with such a juicy part, almost everything that comes after will be a bit disappointing. I mean, Sam, you mentioned earlier on The Name of the Rose, which is also, you know, where I then, I think, 2-3 years later, next saw F. Murray Abraham. And it's a fun part and he does fun things with it, but it's a panto villain. It's paper thin by comparison. And I think it's, in a way, it reminds me a bit of what I personally, when I do my own myth-making, call the HBO curse. If you look at all of these great HBO series of the, you know, early 21st century, the Sopranos, the Deadwood, The Wire, and many people I saw first in those parts doing fantastic jobs with fantastic material, everything that followed up, I always think, yeah, but it's not as good as that. And I think in some ways with F. Murray Abraham, when I then see him in, what was it, Star Trek Insurgency, and I think, this guy was Salieri, what is he doing, slumming it in the worst of all, or not the worst, the second, third, fourth worst of all Star Trek movies. I think that's what I think, in a way, was a shame, that it set certain expectations, not just of the actor, but also the material that they are in. And after material like that, it's difficult to find something that is as iconic. Mm-hmm.
But that, in a sense, that's so funny. In a sense, that brings us back to the theme of the film. It's how do you live your life in mediocrity after you've been touched by genius?
That's beautiful, exactly.
Well, he's become the patron saint of mediocre people, you know, the way he presents himself at the end. You know, yeah. I absolve you, the patron saint of mediocrity. I was happy to see him, though, in Grand Budapest Hotel, I must say, that where I thought, finally, F. Murray Abraham is back. I perceive him in a really good movie, in a really good part. Not a big part, but an important one. And so, yeah, he came back.
Look, I think that the message is clear, is that people should see it. They should see it because it's beautiful. They should see it because the music is beautiful. They should see it because they might look up Salieri and find out that he wasn't that mediocre, really. Come on, honestly. I think we ought to stay out the discussion of whether this film is underseen or still legendary or should be more in people's eye line, the writers, the film writers, the opinion writers. I see it come around on Twitter every now and again with beautiful pictures, and I always give it a like. And I think it's still out there, and I think people should see it. That was another damn fine cup of culture. I hope you all enjoyed it. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you to Matt.
Thank you.
Thank you to Sam.
Great pleasure.
And I hope to see you next time on A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.